This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we've heard, the process of understanding, explaining, and contextualizing terror yields some ratio of reward and risk. Namely, when does the documentation of evil perpetuate evil? For the remainder of this hour, we'll look at that dilemma at its most polarizing, the study of jihadist movements. It's a subject rich with emotion, disagreement, and just plain ignorance.
And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land.
That's not true. The physical territory of the so-called Islamic Caliphate in Iraq and Syria, at one point the size of the United Kingdom, has been reduced to a square mile in a Syrian village. But ISIS as an organization, as an idea, and as a threat, has not been defeated. And it is not idle.
I mean, it's still getting a 12-page newspaper out every single week.
Charlie Winter with the International Center for the Study of Radicalization examines the online communications of jihadi terror groups.
It's still capable of producing very glossy, shiny videos that still resonate very well among its supporters and still have an ability to grab attention. It's just right now, the propagandist priorities aren't communicating with the West. Right now, they're thinking about retention, not recruitment.
Even as U.S. forces seem poised to overtake the last ISIS bastion in Syria, Winter says, the violent struggle continues elsewhere.
Let me tell you about a video that was published by the Islamic State's West Africa province, so it's based in Nigeria. So they opened with a few pictures of children playing in the streets, people going to mosques of supposedly idolatrous monuments and tombs being destroyed. And then there was a beheading, an amputation. And then cut back to more shots of people worshipping. And all the time, there was a kind of sepia filter across the screen. It was essentially casting these things that had happened just a few years ago as this new golden age of Islam and showing the Islamic State at its best. The point of doing that, to kind of revitalize the idea of the utopian caliphate, is to provide Islamic State supporters with something to continue fighting for.
It's morning again in Nigeria.
That's right.
That video was recently put online by ISIS and just as quickly removed by major social media platforms, which obviously don't want to be seen as having any hand in glorifying terrorism. But Winter found it anyway on Telegram, a Russia-based encrypted messaging app. It can also be found on a U.S. site called Jihadology, a scholarly repository of jihadi videos, edicts, posters, and speeches documenting first the breathtaking expansion and now dramatic setbacks of the self-proclaimed Islamic Caliphate.
Jihadology has become an invaluable resource, I believe, for academics and scholars who are trying to study the jihadi landscape.
Rukmini Kalamaki covers ISIS for the New York Times.
It's a place that warehouses the videos and the statements of these groups that are, of course, being taken down online by YouTube, by Facebook, by Twitter, etc., in the interest of not finding a greater public.
While it may seem inarguable that knowing more is better than knowing less, it's not hard to understand the impulse behind cutting off the supply of propaganda designed to lure disaffected youth into the terror matrix. After all, didn't Omar Mateen, before entering the Pulse nightclub in Orlando to murder 49 people, scroll through Jihadology? Yes, he did. And come on, academic researchers of child pornography don't repost the porn themselves.
I used to work child protection, and when I worked with researchers there, they would never share any of the content they came across, because whatever they were doing, it started from a point of not making things more available.
Ollie Fisher, director of the British data consultancy Human Cognition, has written in opposition of open access to archives of jihadi propaganda, and he is not alone. In November, the UK Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee published a report titled The 2017 Attacks, What Needs to Change, detailing efforts to limit access to propaganda on social media. In recent weeks, the European Parliament has debated similar initiatives. Among its likely targets is the blogging and website platform WordPress, host of Jihadology. The notion being, once again, that the videos are dandelions and the websites scatter the seeds of violence to the winds. Charlie Winter, curator of his own private archive, worries about Jihadology.
I don't think we should whitewash the fact that it is and has been useful for groups like the Islamic State in the last few years.
And undeniably, ISIS followers do promote Jihadology among themselves, not just as a bazaar, but as a safe harbor for their ideology. Here's jihadism investigator Ollie Fisher reading from a Telegram chat among radicals.
These links, by the will of God, do not get deleted. All the while, these will help the supporters in their raids on social media platforms. And we advise you, place these links in the comments section on YouTube. It then goes on to recommend the use of a VPN so that the individual person is protecting themselves. And the links that they are talking about there, about 90-something percent of them are to Jihadology.
When the bad guys see your work as indispensable, perhaps that should give pause. Especially, says Fisher, when society is demanding that non-academic platforms eradicate this stuff.
We've seen Facebook, YouTube, under pressure to remove the content from the attacks in Christchurch. And I don't think we can be saying it's okay for one group just to post it all widely on the web, and another group, it's Facebook, so you've got to remove it. To me, it doesn't make a balanced argument.
Fisher also can't reconcile the fact that some individuals have been jailed for posting jihadi content, while scholars and, in some case, governments make the same practice routine. So, yes, it's clear that there is at least some level of double standard. Less clear is whether the content in question is actually what lures recruits into the terrorist fold to begin with.
There's this assumption that ISIS was particularly successful in getting young people, particularly Westerners, to go to Syria because of its savvy media output.
Amarnath Amarasingham is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
And so there was a kind of causal link drawn in the minds of some policy people in law enforcement that because ISIS was so good at its social media, that it automatically led to this foreign fighter problem that we're seeing.
But that formulation, Amarasingham says, overestimates the impact of the propaganda and ignores the more significant factor, two-way social media messaging. If you were an ISIS wannabe,
you could reach out to them, you could talk to them, you could get logistical advice, you could ask them who to contact when they're in Turkey to cross the border. And so it became a kind of personal interaction, and friendships started forming, and this kind of online community of jihadist supporters started forming out of this access to these fighters.
There are a number of people who speak about this material without actually having any real knowledge of how the radicalization process works.
The Times' Rukmini Kalamaki.
Telegram, in their secret chat rooms on this encrypted app, is where the group congregates, and anybody that is serious about joining this group finds their way there. If you take away the conveyor belt called Jihadology, you're not solving the problem. You'd have to basically shut off the internet to be able to completely shut down the way through which young aspiring jihadists make their way to this ideology and then to the violence that it incites.
Now, not all the hand-wringing envisions shutting down Jihadology altogether. The British Parliament is considering the less draconian measure of password protection, and there is some history there. Peter van Ostien is a PhD candidate at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium and visiting fellow at the European Foundation for Democracy. He runs his own archive of jihadi propaganda, which, like Jihadology, was open to all visitors and drew approximately 100,000 of them a month until 2016, when he says he succumbed to pressure from French, Russian, and Indian governments.
Basically, my website is under lock right now.
To get access, you have to create a WordPress account and request entry from Van Ostien.
Everybody gets access. Everybody who asks access to my website, I give them access.
Because he is a single academic without the resources to vet his applicants. How's he to know whether he's being solicited by a tenured professor or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi?
I know that even jihadis got access to my website, still.
So I guess my question is, what has been accomplished here by those who asked you to put this under lock and key?
Nothing. If it were to stop terrorist propaganda and to slow down the spread of terrorist propaganda, it was a very bad idea to close down my website because it basically didn't help. Basically, they can find their content elsewhere. So what has been accomplished? Nothing. Nothing at all.
And what has been lost?
What has been lost? The content of a lot of most interesting tracts, not only by the Islamic State, but also by Al-Qaeda, and some analysis. I had some guest posts on my website of rather prominent foreign fighters and of rather prominent Al-Qaeda figures. I think the information should be there for the general public, not only for academics and researchers, and not led by media interpretations and by people saying, I heard this from a researcher. We need the hard facts. We need the details. And what's more detailed than footage? Nothing.
It's not just a matter of general public and academic understanding. Jihadology has been the source of crucial intelligence. Seamus Hughes, deputy director of the Program on Extremism at the George Washington University, describes his process when, in a court document, he encountered references to an ISIS senior commander, an American named Zulfi Hoxha.
I thought to myself, I've never heard this guy before, and I track this for a living. And so we started going through all of Jihadology's videos until we found people that purported to be Americans and then cross-referenced that with friends and family who knew Zulfi. And we were able to match up both the voice and ultimately the face.
Sure enough, they found Hoxha on Jihadology in propaganda videos spewing jihadi rhetoric.
Indeed, America today is the one carrying the banner of the cross and waging war against the Muslims. It did not delay in supporting its puppets via air, land, and sea.
Hoxha was thus publicly identified as the first American Islamic State member to be featured in a beheading video. Hughes says, by the way, the government, for its own purposes, uses Jihadology too.
You don't necessarily want your CIA agent in a courtroom in New York talking about ISIS. You don't want to expose your assets. And so they're looking for a different avenue in order to get the information into a court of law. And that means they look at Jihadology in order to get the documents.
So that's the impact on the front lines of intelligence. Then there is the matter of just plain history, of context and understanding versus demagogy and myth. Rukmini Kalamaki refers to the work of Miami of Ohio professor Nathan French, whose scholarship includes reassembling Osama bin Laden's recorded justification for 9/11. In the few months after the attacks, under government pressure, that material had been all but eradicated from American TV news.
And these terrorist statements are now pretty hard to access unless you know how to do it as a specialist. And so I've had people actually say to me that they believe that 9/11 was a reaction to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, literally reversing the events and not understanding that the invasion of Iraq came as a result of 9/11.
More information or less information? Which presents the greater risk? And then there's one other thing, not just documenting history, but documenting responsibility. Peter Van Ostien.
We will need all of this if there will be, and by God, I hope there will be one soon, an international tribunal against ISIS fighters. And we will need as much as evidence as possible. And I sincerely hope that everybody starts to realize what they already destroyed by killing off YouTube videos, even of people watching and then filming bombings and what have you. Everybody should be aware
fully aware of what they did.
The irony is pretty thick. ISIS has tried systematically to destroy evidence of modernity. And now, with all good intentions, we may ourselves be destroying evidence of the destruction. We repeatedly reached out to Aaron Zellin, who runs Jihadology, but he declined to comment. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asla Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.